What?
The music wouldn't, you wouldn't be able to hear the music. Your thingy is down.
Oh, the thingy's down. My thingy's down. Thanks for pointing that out, everybody.
Awkward.
Your thingy.
Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 2, Episode 16 of Cinematica. I'm Dance Levin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio is...
The usual thieves and rogues.
Rapscallions.
Yeah, rapscallions. The usual suspects.
That's us.
In today's mesmerising episode, we celebrate... It's almost like a week without cinema.
It is.
well, kind of, because it's been a busy week,
It's been an extremely busy week for festival goers, but not much going on if you're not. We're going to celebrate a New Zealand world premiere by interviewing the director of the post-apocalyptic Western Existence.
A very charming.
Yeah, it's a good interview, isn't it?
Very charming, yeah, she's lovely.
Bertrand Tavernier goes back to the religious wars of the 16th century for the Princess of Montpensier.
Nicely done.
And that's about it, really. We'll be talking about what we've seen in the first week of the Wellington Film Festival as well.
Yeah, it's going to be fast and loose this week.
Yeah.
And I'm exhausted, like my eyes are sore.
Are you okay, so how many films on average are you doing a day, Si, in the festival?
To date I've seen... five. I've seen five.
I did five yesterday, Simon.
Did you? You did five in one
so
day.
So just
you see,
harden
the
up.
The line is drawn.
You see, I've got a business to keep ticking along. I can't just, you know.
Simon, some of us just don't sleep.
You know, I went to one of them. What was it? I went to In Darkness, and that was like an 8:30, but it came out like 11 o'clock. And by the time I must admit, the next day.
It's hard work on a school night, isn't it?
It is.
Those 9 o'clock starts.
Yeah. I've got one tonight with the, what is it?
The minister. We're both doing that one. And yeah, it is tough. And actually, five yesterday was about the limit, I think, of being able to sort of actually take it in.
So I find my personal limit's three, so. Right.
Well, has that become one continuous film? Five films in a day. I mean, I'd be like, yeah, that. What? Hold on. No, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and people ask you what you've seen, and you can't remember what you saw
exactly.
First.
That's right.
It's like, I don't know. Let me look it up.
Hold on, I'll check. But it was great.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, I really enjoyed it. Actually, yesterday was really fantastic. We'll talk about what our highlights of the festival so far will be in a little while. But
can I just quickly, though, like one of the highlights is that I get to have an ice cream and Jaffers and Coke, like on a very regular basis.
Oh, right. And, you know? And
so how did you do with like five sessions? You must have had like five bottles.
And claim them back on your tax.
Well, not that, but you must have been pinging if you had a drink and something each film.
No, actually, I'm very, You're very careful about, yeah, disciplined about that. And actually, I have to say that the embassy, I spent watched all five films yesterday at the embassy in Wellington, where the food and beverage standard is extremely high now that they've opened that new place downstairs.
Yep.
So you don't have to leave. It's not there was a time when you were constantly having to sort of race out to get food from somewhere else. It's not the case anymore, which is great.
It is nice.
Has it rained nonstop yesterday? Very happy about that. Katie, what's in the mailbag?
Oh, we have lots. It's nonstop New Zealand Film Festival tweets because, of course, not a lot of other things coming out. So I'm just going to randomly kind of close my eyes and sweep through this here. So let's start with the Mirka. Two words for gentlemen prefer blondes. Sparkling diamond.
That was so good yesterday. So good.
Let's see. What else? There's so many. I'm kind of overwhelmed. Positive first NZFF review from Miriam Ruth Ross. Back to stay. Sibling breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
Spider-Man. We have a Spider-Man two-word review. Miramar Mike, two-word review for Spider-Man, Teen Angst Plus.
That's a nice work. Nice work on adding a little bit of extra to your two-word review without it being an actual word.
Yeah, that is a good word. Start adding numbers and symbols. Whimsical.
Punctuation.
Wish You Were Here, two-word review, Drunken Nightmares. And another tweet actually from you, Dan, that got people talking. Your two review of The Hunt, horrible beat up, first disappointment of the NZFF. People want to know why.
Why, Dan?
Why? Oh,
we'll talk about that in a second. We'll cover that off. I know that the New Zealand Film Festival is cagey about numbers. It doesn't. It waits until the whole of the program is over before it announces any sort of results. And invariably, it's only the detail is. Only a kind of, it was a good year, it was a tough year. You know, they never get, or occasionally they'll say it was a record year, yep. And but the details often missed out, so they don't feed their box office into the New Zealand box office statistics. So I wonder whether we've seen a big drop off in the box office this weekend. We have the stats for us.
Yes, I do indeed. Any guesses? Any bets?
Counting down.
Well.
I get the feeling there's no change at number one. Yeah. That would be my first pick.
What was it? Was it Ted last week?
No.
No, what was it? Oh, well, Batman. That's right. I forgot about him.
Before we came to where we were wondering what which films would be improved by the addition of a talking teddy bear, and actually The Dark Knight Returns rises, sorry.
No, Magic Mike. Imagine Ted and Magic Mike on the stage doing a bit of pole dancing.
Exactly. I reckon that
I reckon that
the Magic Mike 2 should have Ted as central character.
That's right. And if that happens,
we want a piece of that action.
Okay, right.
Yes. All right, reel them off.
Okay. Sitting at number 5 is The Amazing Spider-Man. Number 4, Ice Age Continental Drift. Number 3 is Ted. Magic Mike sitting at number 2, where it started. It starts at number 2, not being able to beat out The Dark Knight Rises.
Right, and I read somewhere that Channing Tatum has had 3 films released this year, and all of them have done over $100 million
internationally. Does he take his shirt off in all of them? Yes. Yes.
Yeah. But it's the year of the Tatum.
Having said that, you know, $100 million 3 times in a row, and it's only just started August, that means you're a bona fide movie star now.
Yeah, right? He is.
He's a moneymaker. Those abs. Yeah, and Magic Mike, he doesn't even take his pants off.
Kayleigh, you've got to see past all that. It's not just on what's on the outside. It's, you know,
no, it's the glint in his eye. It's the deadpan
look that he has. He is a good sort of, what is
he's
it,
relaxed like, now, well, which he didn't also, before.
He's you know, he has a comedic sort of way, doesn't he? I think.
And of course, Magic Mike 2 has, I think, already been greenlit, so that's already on the agenda. 21 Jump Street, the sequel to that, has already been on the agenda, because the other thing is that his films aren't that expensive to make. Magic Mike 2 might have only cost about $10 million to make. It's made over $100 million. You know, someone's going to want a piece of that action going forward.
Yeah,
I can tell you why I want a piece of that action. Let me tell you. But that being said, he must have a huge following in the female market, because he does have that relaxed screen presence now, and he's always playing the boyfriend that you want to have. Like, he's just this good guy, and he's handsome, and he's smart,
and he's sincere,
and he's caring. Sincere.
Yeah. Oh, sounds awful.
He's like lady. Does, he's like total does. Lady fantasy territory. I need a cold glass of water now.
Yeah,
let's just move on.
I don't like these precedents.
No, I think it's setting way too high a standard for the rest of us match up to. I think I said to you after we saw the Magic Mike screening, Kayleigh, I said, no, that wasn't intimidating at all. All right, festival time. So let's have a couple of highlights. We'll go around the table. Kayleigh, what have you enjoyed the most?
Oh, that's a tough one. I really enjoyed Crazy Horse. I went to the later screening at the Embassy. I've been doing really well at Embassy double feature so far, and I think my top two for just pure enjoyment would have to be Crazy Horse, because it's just like this incredible visual feast for, you know, 2 hours, and it's crazy. Like, it's just so.
Is it crazy because of the film, or is it crazy because of the subject?
It's crazy because of the subject, because like in La Danse, it's Frederick Wiseman just takes this hands-off approach, and you're just watching what's going on. There's no skew to it, and it's just incredible. Like, it, I think he treated it just, yeah, the same way as he would any other subject matter.
The dance was incredibly clever, though, because you think it's just hands-off, and it's not until you get to the end that you realize how cleverly constructed it's been to make some points about the culture and about the society that these people. Was Crazy Horse the same? Did it actually feel at the end that there'd been some kind of amplification going on?
it's, I think there's definitely a character that emerges. He's involved in this because it's all about this putting together of this new show at Crazy Horse and kind of not rebranding, but getting a fresh set of performance yeah. out there. And there's this one character that emerges, and at the end, it's just, I think you didn't need to change it in any way because this guy is just so, he just explains himself so well as being obsessed with things, and he's totally obsessed with the Crazy Horse right now. It's like the greatest thing you'll ever see in your entire life. And there wasn't really any need for manipulation because he just kind of found this nutter guy to do it. Also, Cabin in the Woods was better than I thought it would be.
Me too. I saw that yesterday, yes. And I was sitting there and I actually tweeted somebody while I was waiting saying, you know, this is not really my thing, so I don't really have very high hopes. And then Bradley Whitford turns up, and two of my favorite actors of all time, Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins, turn up in the very first scene, and they do a walk and talk. So it's like Bradley Whitford back in West Wing territory, and he's doing the best walk and talk ever. And I was just, that's it, man. I'm there. You can do whatever you want to me now.
It was and it was hilarious. Like that movie is so funny. And the New Zealand Film Festival announced today, Wednesday, that there is an additional screening in Wellington. So if you have not seen it yet, definitely go. I went to opening night, packed audience, fantastic, absolutely fantastic.
Si, what have you seen?
It's been a bit. I've seen five films. Like I said, I thought that was quite a lot, but not compared to you, Dan. But five. I mean, I started off with Beast of the Southern Wild, and there was a bit of press and a bit of buzz about that. And I went, maybe that was half the problem, is that you've come in with an expectation.
Yeah,
and,
big awards. History for it.
It has, and I mean, it did extremely well at Cannes, didn't it? And like I actually thought it was, so I didn't think it didn't knock my socks off. It was just, it was relatively predictable and quirky and interesting, but not really. I was a little bit surprised of all the press that it received, I kind of found that interesting. But then I've seen crazy stuff like Beast of the Southern Wild, Faust, Farewell My Queen, Last Dogs of Winter, and then In Darkness was the last film that I saw. So, and In Darkness,
What In Darkness is about.
In Darkness is about, it's set in Poland, and it follows these people who escape the Nazis when there's a big roundup, and they hide in the sewers, and there's a range of ages, children and grown men and all that sort of thing, and whole families. And, it's a hard watch, because they're living in these sewers. But there's this Polish character who works in the sewers, who initially kind of starts off thinking that he can do this stuff for profit, and then turns and really starts doing it at a great risk to himself, at great risk to his family. He looks after these people and saves them. When the Russians arrive, he's carried it off. And there are a couple, there are a number of incidents where you think it's all going to fall apart, and they just scrape through. So very moving, but really tragic. Those films for me are always very interesting, and it's really well made and acted.
And it's hard to find a new approach, isn't it? Really, after all these years, to a subject that's been canvassed so often.
It is. But I think, it's a story though. I mean, I think that story can never be told enough, to be honest.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, and I think I just came out of it and I was washed out and quite exhausted. And but I did find that, really well done and interesting. And another story that pops out of that period of history that is, got a different take on it and is of interest. But hard work. But I guess, the big highlight for me would, I found Farewell My Queen a little bit flat. It was kind of like, meh.
But not flat in the boobage department.
No,
apparently.
plenty of boob cleavage. But the highlight, I guess, so far would have to be Costa Boat's The Last Dogs of Winter.
Oh, that's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed all the characters in it. I've forgotten the chap's name who runs this dog sort of program to look after these dogs. But he was, the combination of him and the young New Zealander, I thought was really interesting and really neat to watch. And these scenes where, these polar bears go right up to these dogs and kind of nuzzle into them and have a roll around and they scratch each other. And just incredible.
Yeah.
But also, the place where it is, which is Churchill. Yeah, I mean, just a fascinating kind of landscape.
It does what documentaries are supposed to do, doesn't it? Which is introduce you to something that you just didn't know anything about before, and by the end of it, you feel like you know something more than you did before.
Exactly.
And apparently, I've read a couple of things from people who are saying that the Churchill tourism industry likely to boom from New Zealand. Lots of people wanting to go and check out those polar bears.
Yeah, and it's fascinating how it's such a short, I didn't realize it was such a short window. Like it's only I think 6 weeks where you can get in there and see these polar bears up close and photograph them, all those sorts of things. But then right next to these polar bears are these amazing dogs which have got this history, going back to the indigenous people and how they use them and all those sorts of things. And I think there's only hundreds, I think, a couple of hundred left of these dogs. And it's so frustrating, to always hear these stories. Like there's too many of these types of stories out there.
And just one lonely obsessive of basically keeping an entire species alive. Yeah,
that's right. Where is the government and all this? Where is the money?
And the people of the town are very ambivalent.
They were quite mixed. There were some that were just quite sort of like, well, it's a bit of a nuisance, and the dogs are a nuisance, and what if they get off? And some who were quite, who seemed supportive. But it was a really, really well crafted documentary. I really enjoyed it, and I wouldn't, that for me so far has probably been the highlight.
Yeah, you saw that too, didn't you, Kaylee?
Yes, I did, and it was great because we were able to have a Skype date on the big screen with Caleb, is it? So that was very exciting.
That's a fantastic innovation, isn't it? With digital projection, the ability to do that. With something we've been thinking about trying to do for Cinematica events in the future, knowing that there are so many locations that have digital facilities now, and it's great to see the festival embracing that.
Oh, I think so. I think you have to do that sort of thing. I think it's a great addition. I guess, scheduling it in can be a little bit tough, when you're especially in a festival environment, but they did a great job of that. It was well done.
Well, my two highlights so far in week one, I also saw Beasts of the Southern Wild, and I think I need to see it a second time, maybe not quite close.
I'd agree with that.
I was very, very close to the screen at the embassy for this particular screening, it was a bit overwhelming. I'd like a bit of distance, I think, next time I see it.
But I would like to see it again, because I kind of feel like, was there something I missed here? Was there something that didn't quite click? And I think maybe it deserves a second chance.
Yeah. But my highlight would be This Must Be the Place, which is Paolo Sorrentino's
But what was film. It? Just step back a sec, though. Like, your overall impression of Beasts?
Of Beasts? My overall impression was that it was the first film I saw, and I enjoyed it. I'm a bit of a sucker for little black children, actually, in films about little black children. That just seems to touch my heart in ways that I can't quite explain. There was a wonderful film many years ago called Fresh. Did anybody ever see that? Oh, you need to seek it out. But yeah, it's one of those things that central character, that young girl, Hush Puppy, I thought she was an incredibly strong, well-drawn character, brilliantly performed. And children in peril movies always sort of tend to sort of drag me in a bit. I thought it was a fantastic environment and a way of, it's almost a childlike way of seeing a dangerous world. But I do feel like I'd need to see it again to really get my head around it and decide whether I thought it was overblown or whether it was just right. I'm just not quite sure. But back to This Must Be the Place, because that's the one I want to talk about so much.
You have the floor.
It's so good. This is a film that pushes so many of my buttons on so many levels, whether it's 80s music, whether it's the nature of fame, whether it's Sean Penn. There's just so much about it that I absolutely adored. It's about a former pop star, rock star, I guess, from the 80s, who's living in Dublin in a very luxurious retirement. He has given up the music business for 30 years, but he hasn't given up the look. He still hairsprays his hair like Robert Smith of The Cure. He's still got the full-on eyeliner and the lipstick and the white face and the leather jacket and jeans and what have you. But there he is trudging through the supermarket with his trolley, and people go, oh, don't I know you from somewhere? And so you think this is a fairly lonely, kind of pathetic existence until you meet his wife, played by Frances McDormand, who obviously adores him, and you think, oh, maybe this isn't quite as abnormal as you think. And he is tempted back to New York because his father has passed away, and he gets some information there that completely changes his life, and he goes off on a incredibly surprising, charming, unusual quest. And I don't want to give it away, because particularly if you don't know what happens, it'll go in some very weird directions. And the film itself is sort of episodic and gentle and goes off in its own little tangents, and you don't know whether that it means anything, and it, you know, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, and it's only at the end that you try and tie all those pieces together. But it's the first film that I've seen all year that I literally can't get out of my head. Like, I'm thinking about it all the time. And, you know, that means something. Right, yeah. Mm. And also, there's about halfway through, there's a period of there's a scene where David Byrne, who wrote the music for the show and whose song, Talking Head song, This Must Be the Place, is the inspiration for the title. He plays the song on stage in New York, and it's the whole song for no apparent reason, but brilliantly staged in a way that only David Byrne could do. And you think, wow, that's amazing, but I'm not quite sure why apart from the fact that it was cool and appropriate for the film, but that didn't move the narrative on at all. But this is a film that I wanted to sit and watch it play again. I enjoyed it so much. The only slight downside of it was that it was played on a very beaten up print.
Well, it's been around, hasn't it?
It's late last year, I think. Middle of last year it got released, and it's just about to get a home video release in Europe. And so I'd love for it to get a New Zealand cinema release. I'd love for somebody to pick it up and have a crack at it. I don't think it's got local distribution. But if these screenings are all there is, then we should, they're precious. And, you know, I loved it. I would have sat there and watched it play all over again. I loved it so much. The other highlight for me out of everything that I've seen, Cabin in the Woods, obviously, but also the Marley documentary, the Bob Marley film, which taught me, I wasn't expecting to be told anything new that I didn't already know about Bob Marley, and I learned a lot. It was brilliantly informative and really quite moving at the end, you know. So it's this sort of this year's Senna, I would say, the Marley documentary, and for a different maybe a different interest group, but still, in terms of how well made the documentary is, it certainly covers all of that ground. Those are my two,
because I think I heard a guy being interviewed not long ago about Marley and how he was, sort of his relationships and things like that, and he was a pretty tough
He was a tough guy to live with and a tough guy to work with. But he and what the film makes really clear is that life wasn't a bowl of cherries for him growing up. First of all, I didn't realize this is like the first fact that you find out about him was that he was half white, that his dad was an elderly English immigrant, like a rogue who had left a trail of children all over Jamaica. There's one photograph of him extant. But the fact that he was of mixed race meant that he was sort of ostracized from the kids that he played with and what have you, that he wasn't black enough for most Jamaicans. And then when he tried to reach out to his father's family and the other his cousins, I guess, and half brothers and half sisters, he was rejected by that family. And so basically he just had to harden up as a really young guy. His mother went to America when he was just a teenager, and so he was sort of left to fend for himself, and he discovered music and Rastafarianism, which is one of the, you know, no disrespect to people of that faith, but it's got to be one of the more bizarre religions around. And there's some wonderful archive footage of the visit of the Emperor of Ethiopia, Haile Selassie, who is a god to the Rastafarians, there's archive footage of his visit to Jamaica and of him traveling around in this open top car waving to the crowds of dreadlocked worshippers. And he just looks like somebody who's going, what on earth have I landed in? It quite bizarre, but a massive amount of insight into the culture and Marley as a character, and just to be reminded that, you know, he died at 36. You know, it's just an extraordinary amount packed into. He was genuinely the first third world rock superstar, and you know, he's been dead such a long time now, it's easy to forget. So I hope the film gets a bit of a lease of life, and, you know, people get to find out more about it. It's extremely well made, and lots of very entertaining interviews in it as well. So those would be my two highlights so far.
Very good.
Thank you very much, Dan.
You're welcome.
World Cinema lost one of its legends this week as Chris Marker, or Marquet, not sure, avant-garde French filmmaker and creator of La Jetée, which inspired Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys, passed away at the age of 92. The very ripe old age of 92.
Yeah, and the day after his 92nd birthday, actually. So if you were online at various sites, one day it's Chris Marker's 92nd birthday, and then the next day it's, So they had to repeat all of the career retrospectives a day later. Mm-hmm. A bit of a shame, but a massively influential but not often seen filmmaker.
Mm. Earlier this week, Warner Brothers confirmed the not terribly secret rumors that Peter Jackson's The Hobbit will now be a trilogy instead of the two films originally planned. All parties are protesting that this is an artistic decision and not a commercial one.
So,
to be fair, it is based on two books. They have mushed together two books.
Yeah, but has he knocked this off, like, you know, because, I mean, he makes two films at once, doesn't he?
Yeah, and I get the feeling they've just shot a lot.
Yeah.
It's been, that production, I mean, they've been going a long time, and he shoots a lot. And also, he also has second and third units. Like, if Rings was anything to go by, he has second and third units going simultaneously as well, and he's watching monitors all over the joint.
It's good news, isn't it? It's good news
if you're a cinema owner, definitely. That's three Christmases in a row that are basically sorted.
Yeah, yes. And then you're just looking for the next one.
Yeah. But, the test will be this Christmas with the 48 frames and whether that's a big gamble. Peter Jackson, he's known to want to push the envelope, but let's see how people respond to that, and whether that, in 3 years' time, three Christmases from now, whether there's a dozen films a year coming out in 48 frames or not, whether it's changed the culture.
Well, like I say, I've seen some 48 frames, and I think it's quite spectacular. Like it. Like it, yeah.
Mm. And finally, in our weekly rumor mill update.
Good-o.
The impending production of 50 Shades of Grey, because we love talking about this every week.
Who's the director now?
No. NME is reporting that Harry Potter star Emma Watson is in talks to play the lead role of Anastasia, useless character, Steele.
Useless.
Look, I think that, if that's wishful thinking on the part of somebody, because, like, if you can tie the Harry Potter franchise, which is already, squillions of dollars, into the squillions of dollars that are being made out of 50 Shades of Grey, the only way they can possibly top that is if they got Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson to do it.
Oh, no.
That would be more money than exists in the world.
Who would be your ideal line up for this?
Well, I've just told you.
Then
I can dismiss them. I can dismiss it all easily.
They're in the middle of a tiff right now.
Yeah,
a scandal.
But wouldn't that add a frisson to the whole thing? Wouldn't that add an extra layer of tension?
The young lady out of Winter's Bone. Yeah.
Well, she's busy for the next couple of years with Hunger Games, which is also, who knows how many films that last book's going to get turned into. Once people start cashing those checks, it's perplexing, isn't it?
Mm.
They've managed to get so far for 50 Shades of Grey is a producer and a company to produce it. Like, everything else is just pure.
Who's the company producing it? Is it Lionsgate?
It's Lionsgate, yeah.
Ah, I knew it!
Lionsgate.
I knew it! They have Lionsgate and their trashy trash. I knew it.
Good on you, Lionsgate.
Way to go, Lionsgate. I hope
keep them coming.
I hope they do it to their Vancouver studios. Then it'll just be that much better.
Somebody's got to do these things, Kaylee.
I know, but like, that's what Lionsgate does. Like, they've been getting better over the years, but when, in the early...
Lionsgate are the studio responsible for Cabin in the Woods. They're not responsible for the decision not to release it, although I imagine they're responsible for the price tag they put on it.
Yeah, but earlier in, they've been getting better content recently, but Lionsgate does like the shock schlock, like garbagey horror teen films.
But
that's what they do.
But they
that's what they're good at.
They do. And then you knock them off nice and cheap and quick, and they do the money.
And that's what Lionsgate, for me, that's what Lionsgate is known for.
Oh, yeah.
But they are coming around. They have some bigger titles coming out, and I do love them for what they do. But this is perfect Lionsgate material.
Right.
Why do we heed the dog?
We heed the dark, for it brings the riders.
Who are the riders?
The riders are our keepers.
Why are we kept?
We are kept for our children.
What have you been doing out in those hills?
I've done nothing.
Don't lie to me.
I've been hunting.
Then why do I hear a rider?
How can I know?
And joining us in the Cinematica studio is the director of the new Kiwi film, Existence, Juliette Berg. Have I pronounced your surname right?
Kind of.
That's closer than I normally get.
I can't even pronounce it anymore. It's Berg.
Oh.
but no one can pronounce it, so it's Berg.
Okay. It's been New Zealandified,
basically.
Well, Juliette, welcome to Cinematica. And congratulations on the impending world premiere of Existence on Friday night at the it's at the Paramount, isn't it?
Yeah.
Are you excited?
Nervous.
And well, I know that not everybody around the table has seen the film. Simon, you haven't, but Kaylee has. So maybe you could tell Simon what the film's about.
Please, yes.
Oh, dear. I hope you're editing because I'm going to start like crazy.
Just go for it.
Maybe.
What is it? It's a post-apocalyptic drama. It's kind of like a family living in a refugee camp, so it's kind of Little House on the Prairie with a good dose of depression.
Right.
You might have to edit that out. Otherwise, my raid with Melissa will kill me.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's essentially the idea is it's the story of what happens after everything ends, and it's kind of quite ironic because I ended up writing a movie about post-apocalyptic apartheid.
Yeah.
I mean, and quite unconsciously, which you know, clearly I have very little insight. And it was only during the edit process that it became quite clear of where the story was heading and what it was trying to say.
So I find that fascinating that it's not so. That it evolves, it changes and grows and turns into something else as you go.
Yeah, I think definitely, because it's not a very dialogue-rich kind of piece. It is all about mood and atmosphere and not getting told directly
exposition.
Yeah, I mean
this
we had
precious
to,
little.
Yeah, it's precious little to, little said. I mean, we had to have a bit of exposition, like for the voiceovers at the start, just to try to explain the world, because obviously, if the low budget, you can't really, recreate events or backstories. You just because it's a big empty landscape, so. Yeah, so it is. So we, I think I kind of lost my train.
I'll quick question for you to sort of get us back on track. I guess is that what came first, the story or the landscape? Were you inspired by the sort of the wind farms and the Belmont Hills and the Makara exposed?
Well, the idea was the first movie, El Mariachi, that was made by Robert Rodriguez for, I think, $8,000 back in the day. How he came about it, and that's kind of where the idea came, is he looked at what resources he had and he created a story around it. And we did basically that. We looked at the landscape, the wind turbines, the Karori Predator Fence, which we didn't end up using, and the World War II bunkers and these big flat landscapes without any trees. And then we thought, okay, well, what kind of story is in there? And the story came out of that. So the landscape came first, the environment, and then the story fit out of it.
In the story, the wind turbines are on the other side of a fence, aren't they? And
yeah.
It's a mystery what's actually on the other side. And are people being kept in or are people being kept out? And you never really know. But the fence is being defended by these mysterious characters called riders. Can you explain a little bit about what they're about?
How they came about? At one stage, quite a few months before we wrote Existence, I got interested in the high country of the South Island, and the I don't even call them farmers, but essentially the riders would go out and they'd patrol the fences and they fixed the fences way back in the day. And I really liked the idea of this lonely existence of this man out in the middle of nowhere who's got no company, who falls in love with somebody down in the lowlands. And so the idea is that this fence is patrolled and it prevents crossings And at first you don't really know which side is the good side, and in the end that's the reveal. So the Boundary Riders kind of, because we're trying to tell a New Zealand story, it was based on historical kind of background of the South Island High Country and how the men lived out there on the properties.
And you, or maybe not you, but your production created a language for these characters, which is quite an intense thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, it was this idea that that part of the division of between cultures is the inability to understand each other's culture, and language is a part of that. So you create greater division by making people not understand each other. Because if you have understanding, then you potentially have the possibility of, you know, reconciliation moving forward. So if you don't know what's on the other side, you certainly can't walk up to somebody and ask if you don't understand their language and they're not communicating. So the writers, we wanted to create this dialect of Kiwi English as a prediction of the future, and we enlisted at Massey University Peter and Martin, linguist scholars there, to create a language. So what we do is we'd write the dialogue, what we wanted them to say, and Peter and Martin would hash out a dialect and from it, and they started creating rules for the language, and it became a really interesting process. It was actually quite a lot of fun.
It's like Klingon, isn't it? Because that's a real language now. You can learn that.
And Elvish as well. You can take a university course in Elvish. Yeah. So hopefully, you know,
Victoria
University.
The theory was that we didn't want to have to commit to subtitles. So we wanted that if you start listening to it, you could actually pick up what they were saying. Mm.
And that works. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. You do pick it up. It's interesting. You've got two central characters played by well-known New Zealand screen faces, Lauren Taylor as Freya, the lead woman, and Matt Sunderland. Tell me about how you came across those two and how they became involved in the production.
I think at the very, very early stage when we were working with Tina Clear and the casting director, you know, you kind of have in your mind the dream cast, and honestly we were very fortunate and very lucky that we actually we managed to cast the people that we wanted for the roles. I think it was for Matthew and for Lauren, the timing was right, and it fortunately worked out.
Yeah, Matt Sunderland, most famous for Out of the Blue, and a Best Actor award winner at the New Zealand Film Awards for that, and just the most extraordinary face on the big screen. I know that I look forward to seeing that craggy visage projected on the big screen. And but it wasn't without incident, was it? The production. My understanding is that fairly early on in the piece,
there was
a bit of trouble.
The day before we were scheduled to shoot, unfortunately Matthew came off a horse. And badly broke an arm, and so the first week of the shoot he was in hospital, the poor man, and he was so committed to the role, and we obviously really wanted him for the role that we spent that first week scratching our heads and saying, okay, well, how do we work this, because we've got a man patrolling a fence on horseback who's going to need to be in a sling and in a cast, and so we wrote it in. And it actually worked really well. The costume designer made this wonderful get up for the sling within, we wrote it within the first couple of scenes, you know, something, him getting attacked and breaking the arm. And it worked really well for the idea of a writer being, you know, a damaged man, a damaged
wounded,
character.
Yeah, wounded individual. No, I was thinking just that very, very same thing. Mm. Now, you have an interesting background for a filmmaker in that, you know, medicine.
Yeah,
is your background. So were you also in charge of first aid?
Well, the standing joke was people would ask me for scripts and I'd look at them blankly and start paging through the script trying to work out which scene I was supposed to print out for them. No. I tried to keep it really separately because it's quite a different brain. Like on medicine days, I can't write very well on medicine days or do a lot of film stuff because my brain is just attuned a different way, and on film days the medicine brain's off, so it's kind of split.
So is that how you work things out, medicine days and film days?
Yeah. I mean, it depends. Like if I've got a deadline for writing a script, I just have to work on in the evening on medicine days, and I go through kind of a ritualization process where I turn my brain over to the other side. Yeah.
That's commitment that right there. That's,
yeah, it's quite odd the stuff you do, but you do kind of do stereotypical kind of, things to get your brain. And you can convince your brain to switch over functions. It's just a tool, you know.
Well, if it's a tool, then I haven't.
Yeah, I'm struggling with it. Yeah.
Well, you know, from the neck down, my body doesn't listen to me, but, you know, manipulate your brain.
So how did you make it to New Zealand, and did you have a filmmaking career in mind when you came here?
No. My husband and I came on a medical working holiday, and we ended up in Wellington and grew in us, and we stayed. But at stage I was doing general practice, and I wanted to do something outside of medicine that was creative. And I had a photography background because my dad's an amateur photographer, and accidentally stumbled into a videography class and thought, I'll give it a go. And I became addicted to it, just really enjoyed it. I think it's one of those unexpected, unplanned for things that I wouldn't have fought in my wildest dreams. I mean, I come from a family that's kind of, you know, computers and science, and filmmaking, creative arts was not really something that was part of my life.
Filmmaking, though, is one of the more scientific arts, though, isn't it? So because there's so much technology involved, it does stretch those sort of muscles as well.
Yeah. I think kind of in terms of what the director does, the psychology of the characters and dealing with lots of different heads of departments and working in a kind of high stress environment, I think you kind of inadvertently get some skills and training through the hospital system because you're used to working long hours in stressful situations with little sleep and being able to make decisions quickly and you just have to. So
I think you need almost an apprenticeship in the health system if you're going to a career in directing, because of that multitasking, deal with stress, keep calm, carry on, all those things.
Yeah.
And access to drugs.
scripts.
Oh, right, yeah, okay. You're talking about the stress, and I'd like to just bring up the fact that this is the first of the Film Commission's Escalator productions, which was a couple of years ago, it was announced that they had this new, not micro budget as such, but very low budget production fund. And it was a little bit, there was a bit of a, not quite as much of a competition as the Make My Movie thing, but it was still competitive, wasn't it? You had to go through several rounds in order to achieve funding. And this is the first of those Escalator productions to actually reach the screen. How was it working with such a low budget and such constraints?
Well, I think being somebody who's just starting out, I probably just didn't know any better. So at first, you know, the $250,000 sounds like, you know, your eyes are big open and you kind of go, oh my God, it's wonderful. And as soon as you kind of realize how expensive it is actually to make films, you realize how little money it is and how you're going to have to be really clever about how you go about it. I mean, it's quite an eye opener it's an expensive business and it's costly. And I think the trick of the micro low budget is telling a story as simply as possible and try to tell it as effectively as possible. But, I mean, there are disappointments. You're not going to get as much coverage as you have in your mind, and you do have to make compromises. But the offside of that is you learn to think creatively instead of financially. And, I mean, the whole idea of Escalator was a development program, and I can honestly say, you know, I learned in the last 2 years more than I would have ever learned if I hadn't have done it, and I come out at the other end and I feel like I'll be more effective and the learning curve is extremely steep.
Was this the first time that you'd worked with child actors?
No, I seem to gravitate towards working with young people.
Because there are a lot of kids in this film, and they're all brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, Thomason and Peter were amazing. I've done a few very minor kind of self-funded short films where I use children and dogs, and I do seem to gravitate towards children and animals, and I don't see it as a something to be scared of. I worked in pediatrics for a while, so, you know, and I do tend to see children a lot in my day job. So it's just a different way of working with someone as opposed to if you have an adult.
Yeah, something that I noticed watching the film was how downplayed all of the performances are. That in what is an incredibly high tension, high stress environment, you know, a different film could have taken a very different approach, and all their performances might have been really highly strung and chewing the scenery and lots of sort of action, but everything's really pulled back. And what was the reasoning behind that?
Because it's a post-apocalyptic story that could be seen as a love story, and it is a love story, but it's a tragedy, and it's more to do with the relationships within the family. And I think it was trying really hard not to make it melodramatic, because it just like the empty landscape, the more pulled back it is and the more pulled back the landscape, the more true it was for this world we've created. You know, I mean, I think when you're at the end of the world, or where at the end of your ability to change your life or your environment, you don't go kicking and screaming about it. There's a kind of a quiet stoicism about a dignity in how you approach your life that is beyond fighting. And you are fighting back, but you're not fighting back in a way that is necessarily as tangible as leading a revolt.
There are a couple of screenings here in Wellington in the Wellington leg of the New Zealand International Film Festival. I know Friday night's the premiere. What wins the other one?
Monday at 1:45.
Monday 1:45, so sneak off work. That's right. Listeners.
I'll be there. I'm sneaking off work.
Take a long lunch, and that's at the Paramount as well?
Yes.
And what do you think the life will be for the film after those two screenings?
Well, the next step is our producer, Mairead, is at the at the Melbourne Festival at the moment, at the distributor screening. It's in the breakthrough screening, where she's going to be talking to financiers and distributors. So I think the next step is to keep pushing for, you know, festival entry. And
so there's a market in Melbourne at the moment, is there? And
yes.
Is that Australasian distributors or international distributors there as well?
No, it is international as well, so fingers and toes crossed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I hope that people get a chance to see it if they're not in Wellington. Because
have you got a local distributor, like a New Zealand-based distributor, to release
it? Oh, no, we're still working on
that. You're still working
on
that as well?
Yeah,
okay.
We're still working.
Yeah.
So if anyone's listening.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
0215, no.
Well, it's been a fantastic ride for you since... When was the escalator decision announced? When did you know you would be making it?
We got greenlit at the end of 2010, so... roughly 2 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
And hopefully this ride is going to keep on going.
Yeah. I mean, I think once you kind of dust yourself off and you kind of lick your wounds at the end of it, you kind of say, do I want to do this again? Am I brave enough to give this another shot? And inevitably, it's like childbirth, you forget.
I wouldn't know about that.
You can't do that for too long, though.
Epidural.
No. That's right.
How long was the shoot itself? Because you were shooting in quite brutal conditions up in the hills.
Yeah, we managed to get 24 days, which was absolutely wonderful, because, you know, being a beginner director at the time is what you need. Mm. Yeah.
And so post-production's been how much longer than that?
Almost roughly a year. We all had to go back to day jobs to help pay the mortgage, so it was a little bit sporadic, and we did have some gaps in between edits, which was actually quite good, walking away from it and then looking at it with a fresh eye, because after the 500th time of looking at something, you know, trying to keep that perspective can be quite challenging. Yeah.
Juliet Bach.
Berg's okay.
Berg, okay.
I can't even pronounce it.
Thanks very much for coming and joining us on Cinematica, and best of luck for your two festival screenings for Existence, and hopefully it'll get out even further afield, further abroad.
Oh, cool. Thank you very much for having me.
No, mon père!
Si, vous céderez, il le faut, je vous l'ordonne! Devrait avant leur départ m'avoir donné votre consentement, sans lequel tout se mettrait à boiter. Cette alliance me convient, je la veux. Vous céderez, ou bien vous finirez vos jours au cloître.
Je suis prête.
I think even non-French speakers might probably get the gist of that. That was
ends with a big old French slap.
Yeah,
the Princess of Montpensier,
Sinking Mountain.
Bertrand Tavernier, the director of a French screen legend, and we're gonna give it a quick review because it's actually playing in at least one place.
It's playing Auckland and Wellington at the
moment. Auckland and Wellington? Yeah. Excellent. Well, that means it's definitely worthwhile. So, Cy, you're our 16th century French religious wars correspondent.
For the week.
Here I am again in the trenches of the... There's a sword fight going
arrows.
On.
Arrows.
Simon has dressed up boiling for the oil. Role this week. You can't see, but he's in his garb.
Yep.
So, what's the verdict?
It's what you would expect from, it's an interesting sort of historical piece from, which the French do very well, and it ticks a lot of the boxes. It's kind of, I found the first half to be probably more interesting than the second. It kind of loses its way a bit in the second half of the film. The first half is quite interesting, and it's quite almost a bit sort of more politically intrigued to
that,
it.
Yeah, I think that was possibly going to be my point was that it doesn't really know what it is.
I agree.
Is it about the politics and the court intrigue and the power struggles, or is it about this young woman sort of thrust into a marriage that, or blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and I mean, because that's how it starts. There's this sort of young romance and it gets broken up and she gets married to the cousin of the person that she's madly in love with. It's very close family-wise, which I guess, is absolutely correct for the day. Yeah. And
there were fewer people, basically.
Yeah. And meanwhile, there are wars going on and they go off to fight wars. The men go off to fight these wars and sort of... come back and this young prince, he marries her and the funny thing is, I can kind of get into these things when they're really awful people, but he's not an awful guy. He's actually pretty half decent, pretty straight-laced,
and
but
a bit
his
naive.
Character is, and a bit naive, yeah. But and that was the other thing that surprised me a little bit, and I think that's in the second half of the film where they go to Versailles and it's meant to be a lot more kind of intriguing, but to me it wasn't like they had much street smarts. It wasn't like they were really kind of groomed for that world or her character.
And it's hard to know who was pulling the strings, really.
Exactly, yeah. It was. And I sort of and she was meant to be this, and she is this stunning looking woman who has this pull on men, without even knowing it, she kind of is men are drawn to her. But I kind of got a bit tired of that. I sort of thought, there should be some smart, savvy people here that kind of see it for what it is.
And it felt a bit long, didn't it?
It did. It is a bit long. But I enjoyed it. Mm. I did like it. But I thought, the things that you can find fault with aren't too hard to find.
The production values are amazing. It's all shot in what looked like real castles.
Yep, and they're beautiful. Everything's beautiful to look at, and the way that it's sort of set is great. I mean,
The kind of thing that actually. We in English language, we don't really get sort of knights on horseback, and that era isn't really, unless it's in a fantasy realm. The Hollywood and the British cinema aren't really doing that sort of stuff anymore. The Knights of the Round Table stuff, and so it's interesting that in France they're examining that part of their history and actually throwing a whole lot of money at recreating it.
Yeah, and I mean, it is an interesting look at that time and the religious wars that were being fought at the time, internally. And so it's just that her character for me was actually probably that, it starts off being so interesting, but it doesn't deliver. It doesn't sort of go up another level or two as the film progresses.
Not enough to make you really want to recommend it to people. Right?
Well, yeah, and really kind of buy into her character.
Yep.
Like I thought her character, there's a part in it which is really near the end, which is she's got to make a decision, and I just thought the decision that was actually made was quite naive. Mm-hmm. But then having said that, this is based on a 16th century novel. It's 17th century novel. So it's not, I guess, for the type of novel that would have been written then, and the angst and the toing and froing,
sophisticated psychology, etc.
It probably does, for all I know, not having not read the novel, it probably does sort of capture.
I'll do your homework, Simon.
By 17th century writer Madame de La Fayette, if anyone needs to know. So, yeah, it's one that I enjoyed and would quite happily, pass a couple of hours to watch it. It's not one that I would rush out and see again, I'd give it that tentative, if you like these types of films, then that's the film for you. But if you don't,
that's true.
Like Turn of the Century Chicklet.
Turn of the 17th century.
Yes.
One interesting thing about that I thought was quite cool was the fact that they have these fight scenes, you know, with swordplay and so on. But when you're watching it, it's actually quite slow. You know, they're fighting, but
it's not super fast cutting, is it?
It's not really fast.
I remember there's one particular sword fight where it's all done in one take with a steady cam as it follows them around. Yeah. And so these guys, the actors, would have had to do an enormous amount of work because you don't muck about with those swords, right? You have to practice and practice and practice, and every move has to be, you know, rehearsed and telegraphed and what have you. And to pull that off, to make it look real and dangerous, that's it, you know, I was impressed by that.
That's probably how it was. You know, they would have been heavy. These weapons would have been heavy, and they would have slowed you down, and it would have been a little bit more like in slow motion than probably what we used to see.
Yeah, it's not Errol Flynn sort of rapier.
No, none of that. So it was.
I'm going to put you on the spot now. Do you have two words for it?
Not really.
Okay.
It's okay.
It's okay. There we go, ladies and gentlemen. Mine's bodice ripper.
Woo.
Yeah, there's a bit of bodice.
Yeah, a bit of bodice and a bit of ripping. And that is our single review.
You can't handle the truth!
And the truth it was. That is our show for this week. Thanks very much to Juliet Berg from Existence for coming into the studio to talk to us. Next week, Miriam Ross is going to be back with us to analyse the 3D of the new Step Up film. We're going to be taking the Step Up films much more seriously than they deserve, I expect. Also in 3D is Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Woo.
Next week, all that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite podcast, Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software. That way your latest episode is always downloaded automatically, and please leave us feedback and ratings at the iTunes store so people can find us. And Kaylee, you're in charge of social media. How do people get in touch with us?
Yes, you can find us on Twitter with our Twitter handle at CinematicaCast. We're also on Facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, and of course always online on our website www.cinematica.co.nz.
The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music at the beginning of the show is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, and you can buy that at the iTunes store. And we're leaving you with some more music, having waxed lyrical about This Must Be the Place earlier on in the show. Here is that David Byrne performance from This Must Be the Place, the title song, if you like, performed live in New York. It's gorgeous, and if you get a chance to see the film, you see some stunning staging as well.
Is he wearing his big suit?
No, different. He's moved on, but he has the most amazing white hair.
Nice.
You know, my hair is grey, and it's sort of, I just looked at it, I'm not really trying hard enough, to be honest.
I can do that with a bit of Janola for you.
Excellent. Well, let's talk about that before the next show.
Okay.
That's good night from me.
Good night from me.
And good night from me.
Where I want to be, pick me up and turn me around. I feel numb, born with a weak heart. Guess I must be having fun. The less we say about it, the better. Make it up as we go along. Feet on the ground, head in the sky. It's okay, I know. Nothing's wrong, nothing. Oh, I got plenty of time. Oh, you got light in your eyes. And you're standing here beside me. I love the passing of time. Never for money. Always for Where I be, how we drifted in.